You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Political patronage is as old as politics itself, going all the way back to biblical times. In their latest book, Pinstripe Patronage, Political Favoritism from the Clubhouse of the White House and Beyond, Martin and Susan J. Tolchin dissect a corrupt but arguably necessary practice. It's published by Paradigm, and it is my pleasure to welcome Susan Tolchin, University Professor of Public Policy at George Mason University, to our show today. Hi.
Hi, good to be here.
You and your husband, Martin, who many people will remember from all of his years at the New York Times, collaborated on a book about patronage that was published in 1971.
That's correct.
Have things changed much since you wrote to the Victor? I mean, about patronage.
Well, since 1971, there were five Supreme Court decisions that declared patronage a violation of the First Amendment and basically outlawed it. But we took another look at it in the last couple of years, and it's bigger and better than ever. Only today, it's pinstripe patronage. There's more patronage for people who are more comfortable in a boardroom than on an assembly line.
But I'm not exactly sure I understand how you can outlaw patronage. There were attempts in other ways. The civil service system was a way of ending patronage, wasn't it? All the excesses and corruption that patronage brought?
Oh, yes. In the 19th century, I mean, people would flood the Capitol, Washington, and, you know, try to get jobs because there was no civil service. As a matter of fact,
a president was shot because he didn't give
somebody
a job.
That's right. Garfield was shot. And Abraham Lincoln was afflicted with smallpox, and he saw all these hordes of people outside the White House, and he said to his secretary, "Come on and send everybody in. I finally have something I can give to everyone." So patronage, to answer your question, is as old as the Republic. I mean, they were giving out bags of rice in the Ming Dynasty. It goes way, way back. But it's bigger and better than ever now. And the Supreme Court said it was a violation of the First Amendment, patronage, because after all, if you express your views and you happen to be a Republican and you hold some political office, a Democrat comes into power and flushes you out and brings his own party in, isn't that a violation of your rights to free speech?
But that seems like an odd view. It seems to me that the attempt in the past was to make as many jobs as possible unpolitical, apolitical, where it wasn't a matter of a Democrat or Republican holding a job. So certain kinds of jobs are understood to be patronage jobs, aren't they?
But when you compare us to all the other Western industrialized countries, we've got – I mean, the president has 3,000 jobs. Governors have loads of jobs. And the excuse is that they're policymaking jobs. So the president needs the confidence of people he needs to appoint people in whose confidence he has. But the problem is 3,000 – how can he talk to 3,000 people?
Well, we're not surprised when a politician names his or her campaign manager to a top advisory position. We're more surprised when that doesn't happen.
Oh, that's right. And attorneys general back to Harding have been the campaign managers of presidents. John Mitchell was his campaign manager. Brownell was Eisenhower's. Harding's campaign, and they all became attorneys general. And of course, Bobby Kennedy was JFK's campaign manager. So, you know, you need somebody in a cabinet post who's a close friend, and there's nothing closer than a campaign manager.
On the other hand, some of those people were good at the job and some were not good at the job.
That's right. It's a problem of when cronyism crosses the line and becomes incompetence, so that, remember FEMA and all the disasters of Hurricane Katrina, and President Bush had appointed Michael Brown, whose only experience in emergency management was promoting Arabian horses. And, of course, Bush said to him, "Brownie, you're doing a great job." And, of course, there were thousands of people who were left homeless by Katrina and all the disasters we know. So it's when cronyism crosses over into incompetence, and Michael Brown in that particular job was incompetent.
There were also complaints that many of the people who were being sent to Iraq in the early days after the invasion were really politically connected rather than experienced in affecting regime change or whatever was going on there.
Exactly. And actually, that's the biggest story of the 21st century. There were more contract employees in Iraq than soldiers and public employees.
It's still in the newspapers.
And it's still
as
in
of
the
today.
Newspapers. It's coming out in WikiLeaks, in Saturday's paper, in Sunday's paper, And it's a big, big scandal. There were lots of contract employees, and it's the first time in the history of this country that we've had so many contract employees. And the problem is they're not accountable to anybody. And you, after that disaster with Blackwater, which was one of the contracting companies, we couldn't decide. There was no decision as to whether they were subject to Iraqi law, American law, military justice, and you know, it was a real problem. They finally are. They're now subject to military law, but basically they're unaccountable. And up until then, they were quietly sent home. And the real problem with this—
But I just want to stop you for a moment.
Oh, I'm sorry.
If we award a contract to Halliburton or to Blackwater, is that a form of patronage or is that something else that's going on there?
Well, it is because in the sense we have a chart in our book showing the political contributions to these companies. And Blackwater was very politically connected to the Republican Party and to George W. Bush.
But they're still working for the Obama administration.
They are, and they've changed their name. There was such notoriety with Blackwater that they changed their name. And as a matter of fact, they get these contracts under 30 different names. There are 30 different subcontracts. Now, I don't care who does the laundry or who serves the meals and so on. But the biggest story really in the 21st century is that we are now contracting out things that we never contracted out before, military intelligence, interrogating prisoners, even reporting on contracts. You have contractors reporting on other contractors.
Well, the military will tell you that this is the result of us wanting to have an all-volunteer army. If we had a draft, many of those jobs would be filled by people who had been drafted.
Maybe that's correct, but a lot of those contracts are no bid. Mm-hmm. And that makes them even more susceptible to political to companies that are politically well connected.
So let's go back. You say on the one hand, this whole system breeds corruption and cronyism, and it has a lot of bad things attached to it. And yet, we couldn't work without it.
We can't work without it.
So is there a way of coming up with a way of eliminating the bad parts but retaining the good parts?
Perhaps. I think more public awareness would certainly help. And the problem is that the public doesn't care who buys office furniture, who's there in Iraq. I mean, I don't think the public really cares about all the patronage jobs that are there. And actually, it's changed quite a bit. You no longer want a job as a sewer inspector. You want a job as the president of Fannie Mae. And the president a couple of years ago was making $1 million a year. But he was getting $20 million in bonuses from his politically connected board. So I think, you know, patronage has changed from the Christmas turkey and the job of the sewer inspector to really big time stuff now. And I think that's what I hope the public is much more involved in.
Although if the pay is good enough for the sewer inspector, I'll take it. We hear a lot about the influence of lobbyists, but not much about the influence of patronage. How does it compare?
Well, I think it's connected because we are a money culture now. And we have a marvelous quote from Marcy Kaptur, a member of Congress from Toledo, Ohio. And we interviewed her in her office and she held up a whole handful of pink slips, telephone messages. And she said, "I didn't come to Congress for this." They were all requests for money. And money is a big part of politics now, and the lobbyists fit right in. So you really are – we're between the rock and a hard place here.
My guest is Susan J. Tolchin, who with Martin Tolchin has written Pinstripe Patronage, Political Favoritism from the Clubhouse to the White House and Beyond. It is published by Paradigm Books. Well, Chicago politician Jake Arvey said, "Politics is the art of putting people under obligation to you." In other words, making people loyal to you. And this is a way of doing that, isn't it?
It's human nature. And our politics is very much akin to human nature, and I think that's the best definition of politics I've ever heard.
According to a few news reports over the summer, the Obama administration, despite pledging to put Foreign Service career diplomats in ambassadorial jobs, has in fact put major donors in any number of them, just as other presidents have done in the past, pretty much every president that preceded. The Foreign Service has had thought that the practice would be curbed during the Obama administration and surprised.
The ambassador to the Court of St. James and to Japan are both major – have been major fundraisers in the Obama presidential campaign. And No one seems to want Mogadishu. That's the problem.
But would he have, so that we send the professional foreign service career diplomat to Mogadishu?
Right.
Well, I mean, I can understand why somebody would want to be in England, France, or Japan. On the other hand, those are very important posts, mm-hmm. and I would assume that we're not always getting the best service possible.
Probably not, but these people preside over embassies full of professionals, so I don't think we have to worry too much. And also, those countries are all allies of ours.
Now, how do politicians defend and justify political patronage when it comes to hiring and firing employees?
I think politicians keep quiet about it. I think they quietly work it. And a lot depends on how you feel about a piece of legislation. So, for example, Obama, although Obama pledged not to use patronage, Obama did discover that he wasn't going to get any legislation passed without patronage. So to get his health care reform bill passed, he used the Cornhusker reward and the Louisiana Purchase to get the votes of Ben Nelson of Nebraska and Mary Landrieu of Louisiana. Now, Ben Nelson eventually, because of the public outcry, had to turn it back. But Mary Landrieu was very happy about that $100 million extra for Louisiana.
But is that a patronage thing?
That was patronage. He was using the reward, his power over the budget, to give those recalcitrant senators rewards to come along with him and get that health bill passed.
So patronage is not just a matter of appointing somebody to a job.
No, I think there's a lot of patronage. And in Congress, you have earmarks, for example. Members of Congress are between the rock and the hard place with regard to earmarks, which have doubled in the last 15 years. But an earmark is a goodie. It can run from $25,000 for a mariachi band in Las Vegas to a multi-billion-dollar contract in Iraq. So it depends on how you feel about you know, what you're getting. And members of Congress are between a rock and a hard place because they won't get elected without earmarks. And yet they rail against them. And, of course, the most famous was the Bridge to Nowhere, $443 million bridge to ferry 200 people to the mainland of Alaska. It was never passed because there was such a huge outcry. But members of Congress, it's like free trade. Everybody's a free trader except for industries in his district.
And not just members of Congress, the candidates as well. We have any number of candidates who have been campaigning against these sorts
That's
of
right.
things, and then it turns out that they have received them in their own businesses and
sure.
Justify that saying, well, I paid into the system and I should get something back.
Well, sure.
So it's always just everybody else's earmark but not ours?
Well, members of Congress argue that they really know what the district needs. So it's a question of what that district needs. Now, you need a mariachi band, or do you need a Bridge to Nowhere? Do you need to support the F-22, which produced jobs in 33 different congressional districts. So, it can range from the sublime to the ridiculous.
My guest is Susan J. Tolchin, University Professor of Public Policy at George Mason University, author of a number of books, and the latest is co-authored with her husband, Martin Tolchin, who spent 40 years at the New York Times, where he reported on Congress and politics, and also became founder, publisher, and editor-in-chief of The Hill newspaper. Their latest book, Pinstripe Patronage, Political Favoritism from the Clubhouse to the White House and Beyond, it's published by Paradigm Books, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Susan J. Tolchin, who, with her husband Martin Tolchin, has written a second book on patronage, this one called Pinstripe Patronage, Political Favoritism from the Clubhouse to the White House and Beyond. It's published by Paradigm. And you mentioned that since you wrote the last book, and it was published in 1976, it was called To the Victor, Political Patronage from the Clubhouse to the White House. Do you think that book influenced the Supreme Court and those five decisions that followed, or did you see those decisions as having more of a political implication?
Well, forgive me for saying this, but all five decisions cited our book, so who knows?
Well, that's good.
But I think
you write books in a vacuum, and you hope that somebody's going to read
it. That's right. So they were very. We think they were very good decisions, and we hope that the information that we had in the first book helped those decisions along.
Well, I'm not sure people know what patronage is, and they do know what some other excesses in politics are. Is that a fault of the media?
Well, I don't know. I think patronage is like the ocean. You always say you never know who discovered the ocean, but it certainly wasn't a fish. Patronage is all over. It's all around us, and it's all the discretionary favors of government. And even though one thinks government has shrunk, really 50% of all government functions are now contracted out. So patronage has turned out to be bigger and better than ever. And of course, you know, patronage is everywhere. And who banks government's money? Controllers and auditors and people in positions, green eyeshade positions, really have a tremendous amount of power. The New York State Pension Fund alone was $122 billion. So any number of banks or investment firms that get that are pretty lucky, and it's discretionary.
Many people argue that it's better to farm a lot of these things out rather than to have government do it because it's more efficient. Does it turn out to be more efficient?
In some cases it does. In some cases it doesn't. It just depends. And but one major difference is that a contract employee costs twice as much as a public employee. So I think that's something to really look at.
And yet we keep on talking about getting rid of government waste.
Exactly. Exactly.
If we could get rid of government waste by actually hiring more people to work for the government?
Well, I think it depends on the function. If you're hiring somebody to do a job, you would much rather hire somebody to do it at half the cost. And I think that's the problem. Now, of course, you know, since we've decimated the government, we've deregulated, we've privatized, all the trends of the late 20th century fit right into patronage because somebody's got to do that work. Somebody's got to run the prison. Somebody's got to buy the furniture. Somebody's got to provide wiring for government buildings. And that's patronage.
Are there some states where patronage is more prevalent than others?
Well, I think, it depends on the kind of patronage. The richer states have more judicial patronage because more people die without a will. So you have lots of refereeships and guardianships. So in richer states like New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, states like Georgia that don't have as much money have a public employee in charge of that.
We recently did a segment on some of the problems that we're seeing when people vote for judges, especially to higher courts like the Supreme Court of certain states, I think 39 states, in fact. But appointing someone to a position like that is a patronage job, isn't it?
Sure. Somebody's always doing the appointing. But we are the only industrialized country in the world that has judicial elections. Half our states elect judges, and I think that's a problem.
Isn't there a problem either way? I mean, if the judge is some crony, somebody who's getting it for political reasons, then we have one kind of problem. If we elect that person because there was a nasty smear campaign against the opponent, there's another kind of problem.
There is, but most voters, when they get in the voting booth, don't know whom they're voting for. I mean, they're voting for a judge, but they usually vote the top of the ticket. And the problem really is that judges have to raise money to run for election, and that really is putting money into the judicial process that really can't come to any good. And we have a story in our book about the great case in West Virginia, in which somebody was contesting one coal company was contesting a big award for another coal company, and in between there was a judicial election, and the loser put a lot of money into the judicial campaign. The judge didn't think it was necessary to recuse himself, but the Supreme Court fortunately disagreed.
Hmm. You have called this book Pinstripe Patronage, and we've kind of touched on what that means. But can we go into it in more detail, how this is different from the patronage we know of in the past?
Well, the patronage –
The Great McGinty, for example.
Right.
Have you ever seen that film?
Oh, yeah. That's wonderful. But the patronage in the past was the Christmas turkey. It was the job of the sewer inspector, and it was a way to get – different ethnic groups into politics, and it had many advantages as well as disadvantages. But it was a much more broad-based kind of patronage. Today, there are thousands of quasi-government organizations like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, And the heads of those and the boards of those are patronage, usually presidential or party patronage. So it's, you know, there's a lot more money in the pool today than there was, and the jobs are bigger, and they're more, people are more at home who wear pinstripes, more at home in the boardroom than they are on the assembly line.
So this current patronage approach contributes to the exclusion of certain groups, racial groups.
It does, and
groups,
it also
women, are they more likely affected?
It depends on who's elected. It can also be inclusive. For example, we have a story in there of a former governor of Delaware, Ruth Ann Minner, who was promoted and supported for office by many women's groups. And for the first time in Delaware's history, she appointed a lot of women to judgeships, commissionerships, and so on, and used her patronage to reward women. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it can include groups, and women had traditionally been excluded from politics in that state as well as many others.
So in this case, it's an attempt to redress the inequities of the past.
It is. It is. It's also
– and other people have done. President Bush was very conscious of bringing blacks and women into his administration.
Mm-hmm. And President Clinton, former President Clinton, decided to appoint women, more women to the cabinet than his predecessors. So it can be used – it can also be – patronage can also be used to settle a score. We have a story in there of Warren Rudman, who was a student at Syracuse University. And when he was about to graduate, they said it would cost him $8 for a diploma. And he said he wouldn't pay the $8, so he got an empty cylinder. And 6 months later, he's in a trench in Korea, and he wrote to the president of Syracuse University. And he said, I don't know if I'm going to make it back to the States, but my mother and father would love my diploma. Could you please send a diploma? The president wrote back and said, we'd be happy to send your $8, and we'll send it.
This is like the fireman who wouldn't put out the fire recently.
That's right. So fast forward a number of years, and he's elected to the Senate. And he gets a letter from the new president of Syracuse congratulating him, and they're so happy to have a member of the Senate. And Syracuse University was up for a $100 million grant to build buildings or to do whatever they did, and he turned it down. And Al D'Amato, who was then another senator from New York, came to him on bended knee and said, please, please, we need this $100 million earmark for our state. And he said, no dice, not while I'm senator. So when you try to weigh $8 fee versus $100 million, there's no contest, is there?
On the other hand, it does seem a bit petty.
Yeah.
My guest is Susan J. Tolchin, co-author with Martin Tolchin of Pinstripe Patronage, Political Favoritism from the Clubhouse of the White House and Beyond. It's published by Paradigm Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Members of the Tea Party complain about the rise of pinstripe patronage. There are examples of patronage with Tea Party candidates?
We haven't seen it yet. It depends on if any of these Tea Party candidates win.
Well, for example, Carl Palladino has received quite a bit of money from various state administrations. Would that be seen as patronage money?
I don't see it as patronage money, But the Tea Party has defeated – it's interesting. The Tea Party candidates have defeated two of the major earmark members of Congress. They defeated Senator Bennett of Utah, who had brought back many rewards for his state, and Alan Mulholland, a member of Congress from West Virginia, who had also brought a great deal to West Virginia. So you know, I think candidates are really in a bind because it used to be that what they brought home, the bacon, the pork, the earmarks, whatever you want to call them, they would get reelected with impunity. Now you've got much more budget conscious. You've got a much more budget conscious Tea Party, and they seem to be playing their own violin.
And we're seeing this to some degree play out in Alaska, where. Mm-hmm. Lisa Murkowski is actually bringing back Ted Stevens in her campaign. He was king of the earmarks because Joe Miller is talking about getting rid of any money coming to Alaska from the federal government.
Yes, and Alaska does accept quite a bit of money from the federal government right now. And I think what's going on in that election is fascinating because she's going to be a write-in candidate. So if she wins as a write-in candidate, it'll be very interesting to see which political she'll caucus with the Republican Party. But she's very surprised because she brought back a lot to Alaska. But interestingly enough, Sarah Palin, who is now who was given up the governorship of Alaska, but when she was a mayor of Wasilla, Alaska, she brought back quite a few earmarks to her state, even hired a lobbyist to concentrate on earmarks. So where you are, it depends. Where you sit depends on where you are politically.
You spoke to a lot of politicians. How open were they about this whole matter?
Well, I think many of them were open, some were not, but we interviewed governors, members of Congress, mayors, and many of them were quite open about it, and they were proud. For example, the governor of Indiana talked about privatizing the state highway, and the people who opposed that were the state legislators, because they didn't want to lose the patronage on the highway. They didn't want to lose the jobs as toll keepers. They didn't want to lose the restaurant franchises, the gas station franchises. But the governor of Indiana leased the highways because it really helped the budget to get rid of the highways. He gave a 75-year lease to an Australian two companies from Australia and Spain. And it made his budget look much better. And as he said, who knows if we'll even be driving in 75 years.
What restrictions have the Supreme Court's rulings put on the practice of political favoritism?
Well, it was supposed to outlaw – they were supposed to outlaw patronage in both jobs and contracts. And I must say that they've had no impact whatsoever because patronage is bigger and better than ever. You may not be able to appoint someone as a sewer inspector – but how many sewer inspectors do you have today?
And were they simply ruling on past practices rather than the way the world was developing?
They were ruling on past practices with regard to jobs, but I don't think that the Supreme Court, and of course somebody has to bring a case, somebody's got to complain about it. And I think it's very interesting because in patronage with job contracts, the way you get most of your data on that is from people who lose contracts, and they don't like the way these contracts are being allocated. But I haven't seen any difference since the Supreme Court decisions.
Now, you said that this is a particularly American practice these days, or would we find the same sort of thing all around the world?
I think you'll find the same thing all over the world greater and lesser degree.
Well, in totalitarian states, of course, it is total.
That's right.
But what about countries like England or France or Germany?
Well, you know, there isn't as much job patronage because they don't have presidential systems. So the leader of those countries never have more than France, England, Japan, the other industrialized countries. The leaders never have more than about 50 patronage jobs. So in jobs, there's very little patronage. They have a much larger, more professional civil service.
But
with
Japan,
regard to contracts,
In Japan, there have even been films about the corruption of the system.
That's right.
And some people feel that it played a role in bringing about the current malaise because it was so entrenched.
Perhaps. And it's probably the reason that Japan had a one-party state for so long because they were able to cement relationships. But
well, if that's the case, if it led to that one-party state, one party that just kept on getting itself reelected, and it has gone from being the number two economic power in the world, I think, to number six.
Mm-hmm.
Not bad, but not as good.
Not as good.
a lesson is a lesson learned. Have they changed their system? And are American politicians looking at the negative aspects of that? Because you point out that this definitely played a role in all of the troubles that have led to our recent recession.
Yes, and I think that we bailed out a lot of companies, and the money has been basically paid back. But I don't think people really know what causes this has been a worldwide recession, and I'm not sure of the connections to patronage. But it is something very interesting to look at.
A listener in Idaho has written into our comment line, I understand how New York politicians can get it, but what leverage can senators and congressmen from Idaho use to get any patronage?
Well, New York has two senators, so does Idaho. So they can have –
they
can
trade
have
votes,
tremendous,
don't they?
Yeah, sure. They can – they log roll. They do all kinds of things. So they – I think Idaho is a much more sparsely populated state, so citizens can have much more of an impact on the Senate.
Just hope that Howard Redman didn't go to school in Idaho and you're okay.
That's right.
Are those states or parties whose patronage, are there states or parties who where patronage is more common?
I think, you know, in the past, Indiana had a 2%, famous 2% system, which they've eliminated, where anyone who got a job through the party would have to give 2% of his income or her income back to the party.
Wow.
So, I mean, that was pretty gross. I don't think most states operate that way, but they do differ from state to state.
Well, on the other hand, if somebody was a political appointee during the last administration and now I'm taking over, mm-hmm. I don't want that person in that job, even if that person is fairly competent, because I'm assuming that that person's loyalties are to the other party.
Yeah, and on high levels, people have an 18-month average staying in government. So I don't think you would have to worry if you were in the Department of the Interior and somebody came in over you. I think that person has long gone and probably become a lobbyist at about five times the income that he or she was making in the Department of the Interior.
Susan J. Tolchin is University Professor of Public Policy at George Mason University, author of a number of books. Her husband, Martin Tolchin, was at the New York Times for 40 years, and he is now a senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. They have written eight books now together, most recently A World Ignited, How Apostles of Ethnic, Religious, and Racial Hatred Torched the Globe. The new one, the one we've been discussing, is called Pinstripe Patronage, Political Favoritism from the Clubhouse to the White House and Beyond. It's published by Paradigm Books, and I want to thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much. Your questions are marvelous.